Thanks again, guys.
Join me, Richard Holloway, after the 10 o'clock news. One of the most important voices in American journalism, writer Barbara Ehrenreich, on whether we're ruining our lives in our attempts to delay death. Bellingcat, WikiLeaks, The Insider. We'll look at how open source reporting is changing the nature of investigative journalism. And could psychedelic drugs be used in clinical treatment of depression, addiction, and terminal illnesses? All that and more coming up after 10 on Sunday morning with me, Richard Holloway, here on BBC Radio Scotland.
And the time now, 28 minutes to 10. In the welter of centenary commemorations for the end of the First World War, we've tended to concentrate on the Western Front, where a huge Allied push, the 100 Days to Victory, was underway. But further east, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was falling apart. New nations would arise from its ashes, and the consequences are still with us. Today marks the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence of Czechoslovakia. We'll discuss that country's troubled history since then in a moment. But first, I've been speaking to Karl von Habsburg, the grandson of the last emperor of Austria-Hungary.
My grandfather was very early of the opinion that under specific circumstances, the war can absolutely not be won. And it would be extremely difficult to think what would happen if the war goes in whatever direction. He knew of the difficulty, of course, having a partnership with Germany, who only were thinking along the terms of a victorious end of the war. They had no other perspective, which was very complicated because he was always thinking along the lines, how can I finish the war? Because that was his main concern. How can I stop victims? How can I stop the suffering? So in this case, he was basically ready to even give up certain territories just to find some peace. But it was impossible in the partnership with Germany.
There was a chance, wasn't there? There was an option possible to retain the empire as it was. But that was rejected by the Americans, really.
There were lots of discussions. There were the famous letters with his brother-in-law, with Prince Sixtus. There were different possibilities discussed. But I think probably at the time they were not completely realistic. Because one shouldn't forget one thing. For a very long time, during the First World War, actually, Austria-Hungary and Germany were very successful on the military side. But it was completely clear. So it was very difficult to kind of convey to the own population, okay, we're successful on the military side, but we are willing to stop the war by giving up territory and by basically giving in to all those demands. And that's why he could not really get out of this partnership with Germany. And he knew very well the moment that America would enter the war, the United States would enter the war, basically everything would be lost. But the Germans would not recognize that.
But the immediate cause of the collapse and the nations going their separate ways, including Czechoslovakia, was what? A military defeat?
It was not necessarily a military. It was a dissolution of the empire. I mean, we shouldn't forget where the beginning was. The beginning was really was nationalism. Yeah, it was on one side. It was the fault of all the rulers, and that includes my ancestors, of course, of not realizing how devastating and how long this war would possibly go. So they're basically all of them had the same fault. But the real reason for the war was the rise in nationalism. It was basically the strengthening of different countries like Serbia, like certain Slavic entities, if I might put it this way, in the country. Because, of course, one has to say that the German entity was more or less a territory that was linked together, whereas the Slavic entities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire were different entities in different spaces, like the Czechs up north towards the German border, the Croats down in the south, or the Slovenes. So they were not in that way linked together.
But had that been seen as at one stage as a strength of the empire, that actually all those different peoples actually would rather pay fealty to an emperor far away than be at the mercy of their immediate neighbors?
Yeah, it was clear because they all had the possibility to develop their own culture, to develop their own religion, and they were not really disturbed by that through the central government. I mean, I think always the classical example is if you think about the national anthem. I mean, it's the only country where the national anthem was automatically sung in, I think, 12 official and, I don't know, numerous unofficial versions. And that was totally accepted. And I mean, if you compare to that the possibility of, let's say, the Marseillaise suddenly being sung in Breton and Occitan, anybody would have done it at the time, would have been guillotined or something like this. It was not possible. So there was, of course, the openness to the different cultures and also the different, of course, religion direction that existed at the time that made the cultural background of this empire.
But I wonder if those other nationalities within the empire started to think, look, this is really being run essentially by Germans. Obviously, Germany and Austria-Hungary.
Or
Hungarians. But you were shackled together. I just wonder if that precipitated the move of people like the Czechs.
Yes, there were, of course, certain countries or entities where nationalism was becoming much, much stronger than in others. I mean, the two where it was particularly strong were the Czechs on one side and were the Serbs on the other side. So that's why, also is the reason why probably that war started with the shots that were fired in Sarajevo, because it was basically infringing the Serbian situation. Although one has to say realistically, and that's something which is quite the opinion of most serious historians, is that if the war would have not started through the shots in Sarajevo, it would probably have started a couple of weeks or months later somewhere else in Europe. It was just the continent was basically on a spot where the war was almost inevitable, with preparing the armies, with mobilizations that already had happened in Germany and in Russia. So the continent was going to go to war. Nationalism, of course, was rising in certain parts, and that was leading to the dissolution.
Do you think that would have led to dissolution of the empire even without this massive world war?
I'm not sure, and I really don't want to speculate there, because of course the positive side of being in that multi-ethnic empire was also quite positive. Especially if you look back in the time, not directly at the beginning of the First World War, but let's say 10 years earlier, and you would see that there was quite some movement in the empire on one side. That there was a lot of, administrative reforms, school reforms, a lot of things that would have modernized the country, which, of course, these type of things always went slow, and it went too slow, no question about that. But then on the other side, there was, of course, the Ausgleich with Hungary, basically the agreement that the empire would turn into an Austrian and a Hungarian part. And at that part, let's say, all the Slavic groups that were in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, basically did not have their own representation and were more or less split up between the two sides. And that was definitely an unjust solution. But then, of course, there were people like the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the successor to the throne at the time, who had his personal thoughts about it, who definitely wanted to create a situation where also the Slavic parts would get their specific rights, and that could have potentially changed the whole situation.
And what lessons do you read across from that, 100 years to now, about the possibility of working across Europe, sort of transnational bodies like the EU?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it is always very important to be on the lookout where nationalism is, again, a potential danger. And we see this in so many countries of Europe currently, where you have certain nationalist movements that are very much on the rise. I'm not somebody who is kind of getting in a panic because of that, because I don't believe that they are, since we are a democratic system, I don't believe that they are a potential majority anywhere. But of course, they are on the rise, and I think it is a movement that has proven again and again over the centuries that it has an extremely destructive force and that it has to be curbed wherever a possibility. So that's one side. On the other side, of course, I think one thing we can learn from the old Austro-Hungarian Empire is the fact that the concept, there was a concept of what was called the Reichsidee, which you cannot translate, because if you say imperial idea in English, which would be the direct translation, would probably remind more of India than the idea of what was the background of the Reichsidee in Austria, which was a transnational, international order under the rule of law. And that, I think, was actually, as a concept, a very good example that can also be applied to today's European Union.
That's Karl von Habsburg, grandson of the last emperor of Austro-Hungary. Well, let's look at Czechoslovakia then, and it's been a rocky road for that country and its successors since the Declaration of Independence 100 years ago today. It's been 20 years of relative peace, then annexation, invasion, the Warsaw Pact, the Prague Spring, the Velvet Revolution of 1989 and the Velvet Divorce of 1993. A lot to get through in the next 20 minutes. Joining us now, Jan Čulík, who's senior lecturer at Glasgow University, Adam Kozuchowski, who's in Warsaw and wrote The Afterlife of Austria-Hungary, and from Bratislava, Anka Dragu of Radio Slovakia International. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Hello. Morning.
Adam, first of all, The Afterlife of Austria-Hungary, then take the story on for us briefly, if you can, from what Karl von Habsburg was saying.
Well, in 1919, when the new order for Europe was being designed in Paris, everyone considered Austria-Hungary to be an anachronism, something that belonged to the previous epoch, the feudal times with monarchs organizing the political status quo. The nation-state was supposed to be the only form of healthy political organization at that time, but on the other hand, in the next 20 years during the war, during the interwar time, there was economic depression in Central Europe, and there was a lot of turmoil and the rise of authoritarian regimes, and democracy did not work the way it was supposed to. So there was rising sentiment for the good old times of peace and the monarchy.
Mm. But in Czechoslovakia particularly, though, it seemed to have worked very well in those 20 years to 1938.
Well, Czechoslovakia was a sort of an example in Central Europe. So democracy functioned well there until 1938, when it was when it broke down under pressure from the Nazi Germany. And economy was better than anywhere else, because Czechoslovakia, or particularly the Czech lands, were the most industrial and most developed parts of the monarchy. Mm. Actually, most of the heavy industry of the entire empire was located there.
Yeah, Jan.
In other countries, well, we had dictatorships, revolutions, and the depression was much heavier. So Czechoslovakia was sort of an exception.
Yeah, so Jan, that 20-year interwar period then, was that the sort of golden age for Czechoslovakia?
Well, this is the propaganda or the mythology that the Czechoslovak state did create very successfully about itself. It's an interesting book which came out in 2007, I think, Yale University Press, Mary Hyman, Czechoslovakia, the State That Failed. Professor Hyman is very critical of nationalism, and I really do agree with Mr. Habsburg, von Habsburg here, that the main problem on both sides, both the German, Austrian, and the Czech side, let's say, was nationalism. That basically broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But Professor Hyman actually argues that, in a way, the new democratic Czechoslovak state was kind of modeled on the structures. Of course, it could not have been modeled on the structures of Austria-Hungary. They kind of were fairly Austrian, but now the Czechs were dominant, right? And she, for instance, notices such little things that, such as, for instance, official postage stamps. Only in the middle 1930s, the first Slovak motifs appeared on postage stamps. So basically, there was Czech dominance, even though it was a democratic state. And the Czechs actually promulgated, supported democracy. But the Germans, the Slovaks, the Hungarians were unhappy. And when later on it collapsed, they brought about populism and authoritarianism. So it can be said that democracy was connected with the Czech rulers, but they didn't really respond properly to the other minorities.
And those strains obviously were there from the start, and arguably eventually led to that Velvet Divorce of 1993. Well, let's go to Slovakia then, and in Bratislava, Anka Dragu of Radio Slovakia International. Anka, is there a feeling at this anniversary, or what is the feeling in Slovakia about 100 years of Czechoslovakia? Are people looking back on that united country with affection?
I have to say, first of all, that when my predecessor spoke about how Czechs dominated in Czechoslovakia and Slovaks felt a bit left outside, you have to bear in mind that the Czech clerks and the Czech teachers, which were sent then to Slovakia to help Slovakia, which used to be a rural, less developed part, to help Slovakia modernize and progress. I think that there are still many Slovaks nowadays who remember or, you know, speak with a lot of respect about those teachers and those clerks from the Czech lands who came to Slovakia to help Slovakia develop. Now, back to current times, if you compare all these ceremonies in Prague with what's going on in Bratislava or in Slovakia, we can say that there are less events in Slovakia, fewer events. And for example, October the 28th is not a bank holiday in Slovakia. While it is in the Czech Republic, there are no military parades in Slovakia. Yes, there are ordinary people who still feel Czechoslovak, but at the official level, there is not so much fanfare, let's say, like in the Czech Republic.
Okay, well, if we're going through the history of the Czechoslovakia, let's just dwell on one point which brought an end to those interwar years, and that all happened around 1938 with the Munich Agreement, the Sudetenland going to Germany, and then the war and Nazi invasion. Here is a bit of archive of Edvard Beneš.
For 20 years, our republic was one of the best and happiest of post-war democracies. It was a sane and flourishing state. It was a state true to the political and spiritual efforts and the legacy of our great president Masaryk. Czechoslovakia will be again a free and independent state in a new and free Europe.
Edvard Beneš talking then when the Nazis had invaded, but of course it didn't work out as he had hoped, did it, Jan?
Can I just say, well, this is, again, this part of the mythologizing thing. Very briefly, I was in Prague 2 days ago. The place is saturated with these banners. 100 years of the Republic. Which Republic is this? I mean, there was the 6 years of Nazi occupation. Czechoslovakia broke up in 1992. You know, so there is this mythologizing. However, there have also been some historians who have introduced a bit of a sober note. Petr Zídek, yesterday in Lidové noviny, the Prague newspaper, actually pointed out that after the First World War, Czechoslovakia was economically quite on its knees. 300,000 Czech males were killed. There were families without means of earning. There was quite a lot of destitution. In 1920, Czechoslovakia tried to set up a communist state because of all this destitution. It was suppressed militarily. Then, of course, it developed well. I mean, incidentally, Austria was much worse off. Austria became a really quite a nasty state in the 20s and 30s. Just one staggering bit of information. In 1936, Austria promulgated a law banning married women from working. Imagine that, right? And then it very easily succumbed to fascism. But okay, Masaryk's project, I mean, it was based on nationalism. It was based on exclusivity of the Czech language, of the Czechs. And with hindsight, I do have to say, and I kind of slightly personally hold Masaryk responsible for the fact that I had to spend the first 26 years of my life under communism before I came to Scotland. Because, I mean, the project wasn't terribly successful if it didn't survive for even 20 years. So there was a problem.
How much of a sort of weight on nationalism was the Warsaw Pact? You know, the fact that Czechoslovakia was behind the Iron Curtain. Did that keep nationalism down, or did it encourage it?
Well, nationalism continued being a problem, right? Because, of course, the Nazis were incredibly nationalistic. Then in 1945, you had atrocities from the Czech side against the Nazis, which was a response to the incredible atrocities of the Second World War, which we no longer really can realize.
There was a mass expulsion of Germans,
There were kind of popular sort of atrocities against women and children in the first sort of months of after May 1945. Then this was done officially with the agreement of the Allies. But the deportation of the Germans, the 3 million Germans from Czechoslovakia and similar numbers from Poland to the West, actually did push both Czechoslovakia and Poland into the embrace of Stalin. It became more authoritarian. And it's very interesting because communism actually taught you that you had to be a cosmopolitan, working-class person, yet at the same time, it was a nationalist state, mildly nationalist.
Well, let's speak to Adam Kosachowski again. Adam, we're just sort of jumping ahead slightly, but to 1968 and the Prague Spring. Was there any feeling elsewhere in the Warsaw Pact countries that you know, this might be the start of some liberalization throughout the bloc?
In 1968, Poland was another country where we had a sort of an attempt for a revolution. But that was also mostly a student movement, and there were protests against the way the Communist Party behaved and against their propaganda, and some demands for liberalization. But that was met with strong resistance and strong response from the communists, much quicker than in Czechoslovakia. So people got arrested and beaten and so on. And what was particularly characteristic for Poland at the time, that was an anti-Semitic and nationalistic campaign of the communist authorities, which claimed that all those who are not happy with the party, and they were cosmopolitans or Jews, and many people left Poland in that time. I think nothing like that happened in any other communist country except for Czechoslovakia and Poland in 1968. Hungary, for example, was under a strong dictatorial regime from their uprising in 1956.
Yeah. Let's go to Bratislava and Anka Dragu. Of course, Dubček, who was the figurehead in 1968, was a Slovak. How do people in Slovakia view the events of 1968?
Well, I think that Dubček is still like an icon figure, although in the past years, historians have started to look at Dubček in a more, not critical way, because Dubček was a communist and Dubček was assigned to the so-called Peyton Law, which actually led to the repression against the intellectuals and against the people who opposed the regime. So I think that he is still an icon in Slovakia, but there are more and more people who question this image.
Let's jump forward then slightly to 1989, when finally communism did leave. And I'll play you a little bit of actuality of Czech pop star Marta Kubišová being welcomed by the crowd in Wenceslas Square.
Ať mír dál zůstává s touto krajinou. Zloba, závist, zášť, strach a svár, ty ať pominou, ať už pominou.
Marta Kubišová there with a prayer for Marta. And Jan Čulik, what's the significance of that event? Because it, for many people, that was the beginning of the end, or was the end for communism?
I was 15, 16 in 1968. When you played this, I still find it incredibly moving. This was the kind of icon song of the Prague Spring. And of course, Marta Kubišová kissed Dubček. And therefore, thereafter, after the Soviet invasion, she was totally banned. She was an absolute non-person for 20 years. She worked in some menial job or whatever. So when communism was actually collapsing during those few heady days in November 89, she would obviously be called onto Wenceslas Square and basically the meaning of this was that the liberalizing times were returning. Of course, then in 89, nobody really knew what was going to happen. Many people thought that the Prague Spring under socialism would kind of be reinstated and continue where it was stopped by the invasion. Not very many people actually expected that capitalism would take over and that actually there would be this capitalism without any sort of social measures or whatever.
It was unrestricted capitalism.
That was imposed upon the Czechs without really realizing what was going on, frankly. Yeah.
But it's only, 4 years later that there's this. So that was the Velvet Revolution of 1989. It's only 4 years later that the Czech Republic and Slovakia go their own way.
That was the work of politicians. I think it would be interesting to hear the view from Bratislava, but until the very last end, before the breakup of the two countries, I think 60% of people, both in the Czech part of the country and in Slovakia, didn't want the division of the state. But it was actually Václav Klaus, who was a kind of Thatcherite right-winger, and the post-communist Vladimír Mečiar, who basically agreed that they couldn't actually keep the nation together. And it's interesting, I mean, there are very good relations now between Slovakia and the Czech Republic. The Slovaks, however, have the euro. They are actually more advanced in a way, while the Czechs have kept their crown. Both countries are in Schengen, so there are no borders. There are lots of Slovaks studying at Czech universities. There are good relations, so it doesn't really probably matter that they are two small countries. But still, I think many people feel that it was a mistake to divide the country.
Well, let's get the view from Bratislava. And Anka Drago, I know that you're actually Romanian, but you've lived in Slovakia for quite a long time. How's that velvet divorce viewed now?
I think that after so many years, because Slovakia is a success from the economic point of view, people now think that it was a good idea to actually split. Although I have to agree that, yes, it was a decision of two politicians, and yes, people are still angry that nobody asked them, that there was no referendum back in 1992, for example, to ask people what do they think. But now in 2018, people think that it's okay as it is. Of course, there are many students and many Slovaks who go to the Czech Republic to study and to work. Czech Republic is still very important. The Czech culture is still very present in Slovakia. But the general conclusion is like it's good as it is right now.
Yeah, and I know that part of what you report upon is EU matters and the future of the EU. But also that Slovakia is part of this Visegrad group, which is sort of doesn't want too much change. Is that right?
Slovakia now holds the rotating presidency of the V4. I know that the logo or the main goal is to bring V4 closer to the EU. Because if you look, Poland and Hungary are in trouble. Czech Republic is in a very unclear position. Czech Republic has always had an Eurosceptic group of people, politicians. So Slovakia suddenly is in the position of being the good guy in this group. So yes, there is a strong pro-EU sentiment in Slovakia. Eurosceptics are really a tiny, tiny minority.
Anka Drago in Bratislava, thank you very much. We've just got time for a very brief word from our paper reviewers who've been listening to all of this, Peter Gagan and Katie Grant. Your views?
It's fascinating. It's fascinating to hear this kind of the history of this kind of state. And as Jan flags it up, there's kind of almost narratives that you hear been brought up about that maybe aren't quite accurate in some ways. You think it is golden era of democracy, and actually to think that what was happening in the 20-year spirit between the wars is actually probably quite different for a lot of people who are there. Maybe kind of sowed the seeds of what happened later on.
We've all learnt a bit, Katie, haven't we?
Certainly a lot. When we were small, we had a Czechoslovakian string quartet when I was little, so still under communist rule. And one of the presents they bought was a Czechoslovakian dress which we absolutely loved. I hadn't seen the wider significance, but now I think it was a gift with a message.
Katie Grant, thanks very much. Peter Gagan too. And also Jan Chilik and Adam Kuzachowski you heard from. GMS is back tomorrow, 6 o'clock.
On digital radio, 92 to 95 FM
and 810 medium wave.